Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Positive Education Podcast. My name is Ash Manuel, and before I introduce today's guest, I want to share with everyone about the world's biggest gratitude event coming up on September 11. Now, the purpose of this event is to bring young people together from around the world to practice gratitude. This is our sixth event, so it's become an annual event. It started off in COVID, and the purpose is just to make young people understand there's always things to be grateful for. Because when it started back in COVID, it was challenging times. Students were learning from home. There was lockdowns, a lot of unknown, and a lot of negativity in the world. So I just had one of those aha moments where I thought, well, what if we can bring young people together to practice gratitude? Because yes, it was tough times, but there's always something to be grateful for. And that's how the event started. And this year, as I mentioned before, we're into our sixth year of the event. So go to bigclass.growingwithgratitude.com.au. We'll put the link in the show notes. It's a free event. We have about 50,000 students last year register, or their teacher registered their class or their school from about 40 countries. So it's a great event. Really, how could you explain it? It's pretty amazing to see, because the students will be able to see each other on the screen. It's just a really cool event where different cultures, different backgrounds come together to practice one common thing, and that's gratitude. So have a check out the link, and really excited for the event coming up on September 11. Now, today's guest, I'm really excited to introduce Sagar Bahara. Now, Sagar is Executive Director for India, South Asia and Southeast Asia at Acumen. Now, through this wide-ranging conversation, we talk about some really interesting topics. I'm really personally interested about international education. I'm having worked with high school students about to come to Adelaide to study, but also I've worked with Adelaide University and done in-person workshops and pre-departure workshops with their international students as well. So we unpack about where international education is at. Really interesting thing we talk about quite early on in the conversation is, particularly in India, there's only 2% of Indian students that actually study abroad, but 58% aspire to international learning. So the question that we discuss is, how can we bring international education to those students? It's a really interesting conversation. We also talk about the cross-cultural student well-being, about particularly studying abroad, how we can help young people with well-being, whether that's higher education or high school students, but also with the academic pressures. We just talk about how young people can handle and the pressure perhaps in some countries and the competition for places at university, and that can cause mental health issues as well. And we talk about a lot of other things as well. And it's a great conversation. Really grateful that Sagar was able to come on and have this chat. And without further ado, we'll get into the episode. Sagar, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Lovely to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on. And very shortly, we'll get into what we're going to talk about today. But I always love to ask guests how they came to be what they're doing today. So for me, I always wanted to be a professional sports person through my teenage years. That didn't quite work out, but I had a goal. Did you have a dream or aspirations when you were growing up through your teenage years, or did you always want to be in higher education or in education in general?
I think education for me, Ash, was accidental, but very fortunate to, be in this sector. But in my formative teenage years, always idolized, the profile of my dad. He was in the construction natural stone business. And I saw him doing, what he did with a lot of passion. And right from an early age, I started assisting him, going on internships whenever there was a break, being on sites, being on quarries. And all my, I think, years right through higher education was totally based on the understanding that I'll be working with him at some point. I had gone to Singapore for my master's. I came back and I, as expected, started a small venture under his wings in that same business. And I think within 1.5 years while working on sites and coming back, I think I often used to complain that I'm losing the sheen of what I've learned outside. This is something I'm happy doing, but I do miss, that international flavor. And in 2009, I got the opportunity from a Singaporean institution who wanted to come to India to do something, explore the market. And I requested my dad that can I just maybe for a couple of years just help them do something. And then there was no looking back. It's almost 18 years in the sector, loving it now.
Brilliant. That's a great story. So when you went to Singapore to do your master's, what did you do your master's in?
That was an international business, again, with a focus of how I would live the dream of what I was supposed to do. So that was the focus there. And I think there was a lot of learning, given Singapore was that gateway and still is the gateway between East and the West. So there was a great experience there.
Brilliant. I love that. And with now you're with Acumen. So
Yes.
is that who you started with in Singapore, or how did you end up with Acumen?
I started with the Management Development Institute of Singapore, one of the oldest private education groups there. From there was a shift to Amity Education Group, which is India's largest private education group. I spent 8 years there, and I think that was the basic foundation, which I'm very grateful for. Had the opportunity to work with the promoters at a very early age. And the vision that I was very fortunate to be a part of was to take Indian education outside of India. And we're talking about years 2011 onwards. We were successfully able to open 16 international campuses, within 8 years. Massive experience taking Indian education to the US, Africa, Southeast Asia, Europe. So that was a major, major, I think, growth learning trajectory. And from there, there was an interesting assignment with the University of Queensland, who were trying to revamp how a top international university from Australia should be working in India. I think they were looking beyond just recruitment, and that really excited me. So I made that shift after 8 years of Amity, 3 years worked with UQ, with a great vision of opening joint institutions with the IITs in India. Doing a lot with schools, with students. And I think that was the other side of the sector of how foreign education comes to India. So that was a great experience. I then started on a journey with my director at UQ. Both of us started something, in our own consulting. Did that for a couple of years, and then Acumen happened for now, I guess.
Oh, brilliant. That's a great story. Love that pathway to where you are today. And yeah, appreciate you sharing that, Sagar. So I'm interested to know, with you, we actually talked to the other a couple of weeks ago about this, and I found it really interesting. So you mentioned that 2% of Indian higher education students currently studied abroad. Now, it's only 2%. I thought it would have been much higher, but you also mentioned that 58% of students, Indian students, want to or aspire to access international education. So, what are some of those ways that institutions can bring the world to them? So, how can we, I guess, internationalize education to make it more accessible to those students who do want a taste of international education?
Yes, Ash. So I think a lot of people, when they look at India, may not be able to understand the scale and the magnitude of what we talk about. When you look at just the education landscape, we have 260 million school learners in India. That's double the population of Japan. So I was in Japan a few weeks back, and I was trying to give them a flavor that the total population of Japan, we have twice that size in just schools. When you look at higher education, that's 40 million, growing, at a very fast pace. Out of that, all the excitement that you see in the sector is for that segment of students who really can, or do travel outside. They travel abroad for higher education. But when you see the larger scheme of things, that's just 2% of that 40 million. And what in acumen we are trying to assess, especially seeing what's happening globally with visa regime changes and kind of each country trying to protect how the student mobility works. And there are no pressures like accommodation and other factors. We're trying to go to universities and education stakeholders to say there's a much larger audience in India. That 98% that is left behind in India, 58%, as we're doing this report, which will be published next month, are aspiring some form of internationalization. Now, I think they're very aware, given the world we live in, that either culturally or financially, they may not be able to travel, for the whole kind of an experience. But our study then brings out what internationalization means for them. For example, a lot of them are happy for some foreign faculty members to come and spend time with them, over some modules. Some of them are happy to travel for a week or 10 days, 15 days. They're happy with insertion of foreign certifications within their existing programs. A lot of them will be happy to have an international branch campus, which we are seeing from Australia and UK coming to India. So I think this is one of the mega trends which Acumen is tracking, that how do we make education, quality education, accessible to the larger audience in India?
Yeah, that's so interesting. And it's I guess it's a great opportunity for like foreign institutions as well. Like I think the University of Queensland have got a campus in India, is that correct, or am I wrong?
So University of Queensland has a joint institution with IIT Delhi, where they have a very beautiful joint PhD program funded by UQ. So that's great capacity building and that talent, high quality talent, which can be helpful for both countries. So yes.
Yes, it's really, I can see that's such a big opportunity for so many like universities like in the US or Australia or wherever to actually take campuses to the people in India or the students in India who do want to access their education. So with the you mentioned about students could possibly spend like a couple of weeks overseas studying or doing some modules by the lecturers or the people coming to them for a couple of weeks. Are we accessing online? Is it possible to do online study from India into the other in over abroad universities and be a recognized, I guess, degree?
I think traditionally, how India worked, and this was pre-COVID, I think there were a lot of hesitations around how online education was not considered to be at par. I think COVID really taught all of us, a lot of lessons, and one of the major lessons was how Indian schools and universities, students, parents, everyone started seeing how technology has really evolved, how institutions were better ready to quality education. Right from preschool, everything shifted to online. And I think that's really opened up post-COVID, where we're seeing a lot of cooperation between universities, between K-12s as well, where you are doing a lot of online delivery. Hybrid, of course, works much better than online, but again, there's a larger acceptance of how that works. A very beautiful example of that is we were leading a delegation of Australian K-12 schools to India. And while the usual agendas were being met, there was a school in India which developed a partnership and an understanding with an Australian school, which had Indian diaspora to teach Hindi to the Australian campus virtually. Just to keep the love for the language alive, the parents were very happy. And of course, at no or low investment, this kind of exchange is just a great testament of how, this can really grow.
No, yeah, it's an awesome story. Absolutely. It's I guess that, and that's hopefully it's another, I guess, a way that we can open up international education as well. And one thing with you mentioned about school then with schooling in India, I've been to India before and done some work at the Apijay Institute in Delhi, but I've never actually found out. So how does the education system work, say, from going from secondary school to higher education? So in, for example, in Australia, we go through up to year 12, we apply for our university courses and we get a mark overall mark out of 100. And if you get enough marks and the course recognizes that, you get into that course. But if you don't get into your first priority, then you might get into your second or third. How does it actually work in India going from secondary to the higher education?
Okay, so I think there'll be a couple of answers there. India, like will have many different Indias within the same. I'll pick up two segments. One will be the metros, the tier one, tier two cities, and then again we have the masses, generally, in other regions as well. I think one of the other trends which I would like to highlight is now, if you see tier one and tier two cities in India, and the kind of schooling systems, the first choice that parents and students are now making is after grade 5, where I think the first choice they come now is to make a decision whether they continue in the Indian curriculum, whether they want to go to a Cambridge or an IB curriculum. So a lot of schools now have this option that opens up, and I think it's not an easy decision for parents and students, because it's still early. But again, India is one of those countries where international education and the K-12, so international curriculum, really is coming in. Australia has now started WAIS and SAIS as well. So we have the Australian International Curriculum School. So that gives more variety and options. But typically now, coming to what happens after grade 12. So in grade 12, given the curriculum, if it's an Indian curriculum, they'll all go through the standardized CBSE examination, which is conducted, of course, under all government frameworks and regulations. And then, as soon as I think those results are out, I think by then we're already expecting students to know what's going to happen. So they have predictive scores, they have their aspirations set. They 6 months in advance, or even 1 year in certain cases, know their what's their plan A, plan B, plan C. One of the first options for Indian students, again, two segments there, would be going out by whatever means. So there's that section of students who are very clear to go to the UK, Australia, US, Canada, New Zealand, Ireland. These are the big four plus two kind of destinations. And usually for each of those destinations, they'll have 4 to 5 different places in order of their preference. There's another segment who are very aspirationally looking at the IITs in India, so the Indian Institute of Technology, another kind of that league of colleges, both in public and private places. Now, given the skills that we talked about, there are limited seats. Within those limited seats, you do have certain reservations as well, which means there are quotas for different, segments, which makes it very, very competitive. So, let's say for one of the IITs, we were seeing, for 500 odd seats, you will have maybe 500,000 applications coming in. So, that's the kind of competition we go in. For Delhi University, if you see, you have cutoff for eligibility going to 99.2%, which means, it's just practically difficult. Even in that, you're in waiting list 1, 2, 3, so it's massive. So then I think the role of a lot of private institutions come in, which really are growing in number, giving that kind of access. A lot of government institutions are already there in place to help. But I think mostly when you see the larger segment are able to find those kind of places. I think in India, students, parents both are very resilient, very adaptable. So if it's not option A, they'll be happy to go to the option B, C, D. I mean, we are living in a society where education is a continuous stream. So, unlike many foreign countries, a student will be hesitant to take a break here. They will continue that journey till post-graduation and then start the job. That's the cultural leaning we have.
Interesting. That is really interesting. It sounds like there's a lot of different paths that you could take to get to your higher education. But then once you get there, it seems very competitive and there's not many places. The reason why there's not many places is that the universities don't have the capacity to accept too many students, or is it more, okay, once they do graduate, there's not going to be jobs for them, so they can't accept too many, or is it a combination of both?
So Again, just to quote a text, a statistics which I heard in a conference was, so India has an ambition as per our national education policy that our gross enrollment ratio has to be around 50% in the next few years. If that is the case, and given the scale that we have, we need 14 new universities every week till 2035. That's a staggering fact of what India needs to cater to the population coming from, so all the school leavers coming to higher ed. So that's the scale that we need. We completely understand that's not a possible kind of scenario, which means that that's where we are also encouraging students to see options around skilling. So a major kind of an agenda for the government of India is how do we get students excited about skill development, so a lot of skills university, skills institute, and get them into the vocational or kind of employability kind of streams. So that's I think ways where government is trying to see how do we make this accessible. One of the other very good example here is that IB has got the approval from India for the IBCP program, which is the career programs they have, which is more vocational work-based programs. So I think the government here understands the kind of skills we are looking at, what take for students to be absorbed. Having said that, in terms of GDP, India grows really, it continues to grow fast. There are a lot of job opportunities. But again, we're talking about skills which will always be difficult to manage, at some point of time.
Absolutely. And I think, like, I mean, it's such a, like, I love India as a country. Like, as I said, I've been there a few or a couple of times, and it's such a great place to be. And it's crazy, like, in terms of coming from Australia, where it's a bit, I mean, there's traffic, but you don't see, unless you get there, you don't understand how the chaos that it can be. And there's so many, like, opportunities there. Like, it's just, it's one of the growing, I guess, countries in term economically, and so many things going for it. And it sounds like the government's on the right track as well, and a lot of good things happening. Just one thing that you mentioned before, Sagar, is about the tier one and tier two cities. What does that mean, and how do you become a tier one and tier two city? How does that get ranked?
Historically, Ash, we've had the metro cities where I think from the 90s we saw a lot of momentum in terms of investment growth, like key centers where businesses and government really operated. So you'll see Delhi, Mumbai, Bangalore, Hyderabad, Chennai, Calcutta. So these would be cities where obvious choices of where internally also a lot of movement and mobility of people for employability, corporates, education. What has happened, which has been a great journey for all of us, even as kids, to see, would be the addition of a lot of other cities which have really, come up as satellite cities or major cities, where businesses and people have started building those as centers. The current government, a few years back, listed out smart cities. So they announced 100 smart cities for India, which where really all the investment and the growth plans were declared. So even when universities are now looking at India, as acumen, we are very clear that see, of course, we all know the core five or six cities that we have, but where there's potential, where there's more aspiration, and less access, still exposure will be these other cities that are really growing up. And for example, Jaipur, Chandigarh, Coimbatore. There are multiple cities which may be state capitals in India, where businesses are now going, education institutions are going, and there's a lot of employability and growth opportunity as such.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. And yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And one thing I was thinking just before, and we spoke about this earlier as well, is just going back, this is probably going back a step with what we're talking about before, but one thing that I learned about when, like, someone, like a student, does their education in India, through an Indian university, then they finish the degree, then comes and moves to Australia. Their degree wasn't recognised, like, in Australia, but in the last couple of years, that's changed, and there's that mutual, I guess, reciprocation, or mutual recognition of degrees now. Is that something that is talked about, and I guess encouraging young people to stay in India to study because they know if they want to move overseas, it is that mutual recognition now where it wasn't before.
The last, I think, 5 to 7 years, Ash, we've seen one of the best periods for cooperation between India and Australia across all fronts, and you'll see the Quad coming in. So, there are cooperations at multiple levels. What excited us the most was how education really became one of those bridges between the countries. And a testament of that was the first two foreign universities coming to India to set up the campus were from Australia. So we had the Deakin University, University of Wollongong coming and setting up, the first kind of, showing the world what can be done. A big part of all this momentum was both countries coming together and recognizing, qualifications on both sides. So there's now a clear understanding between the two governments that qualifications which are recognized, in the home country will be recognized mutually on the other side between Australia and India. And the best part is it's comprehensive. So we're also talking about K-12, which now leads to a lot of Australian state curriculums coming to India, and that acceptance of how Indian curriculum can also be, looked at. And similarly, of course, for higher education, where there's a lot of comfort now of what India, offers acceptability in Australia and vice versa. And it's not just the full mobility now, even credit transfers, lateral movements, it just opened up, a lot of opportunities between the two sides.
Yeah, that's so good to hear because I used to feel for people like they might come from they finished their degree, they've done all the hard work, they come to a new country and they've got to start again. And that used to be make me sad because you can just imagine putting that effort, but so good to hear. And that's reasonably new. I think it was in the last 18 months that or last probably 2 years that's sort of came to be, which is really good news. Now I just want to transition, Saga, into some well-being because obviously, well, personally, what I really passionate about is well-being of students, whether that's in school or universities. And I've come to work with international students, so high school students who are about to leave their countries and come to Adelaide to study at high school. I've done some pre-arrival sessions through the South Australian government schools, which has been great, just to prepare them and give them some ways of thinking about how to prepare themselves before they come. Maybe some challenges that might come up. How they can help themselves and be responsible for their own well-being when they are here, because they're going to come up with, there's definitely going to be challenges. It's the same with university students. So I've done some sessions with the University of Adelaide, where they're about to have some international students come to the campus, and that they'll be actually moving to Adelaide, and just how, again, like how they might be able to deal with some challenges that come up. So I've done that online, but also in person. I've gone in there and done some sessions, and it's. I love the international, like the student, I guess, system. It's such a good thing. And it's such a daunting thing, I guess, when they first start out because they're going to a totally foreign country, new culture. It's such a challenging thing. So I was just interested to know from the well-being side in higher education, wherever that, whether that's in the preparing students to go from, say, in India to a different country to study or in general, because I understand that. In particularly in India, there's a lot of competition, a lot of pressure academically. So how do, I guess, institutions, whether that's in high schools or higher education, look after or help with well-being of students?
So I think at the outset, cross-border education, of course, is exciting, but it's, at times very unsettling, especially for students, who are going out for the first time or less exposed to, how things work outside of India, especially when we talk in India. From my own experience, when I had gone, post my graduation, I think there were challenges that I personally saw. And it's not just about missing your folks and not being in a familiar place, but also things like how do you manage your finances for the first time? How a small decision of where you stay makes that difference for the next 2 years. And also how responsibly you take the temptations of part-time jobs. I mean, you're there to study. And again, these are concepts, which will slowly trickle down in those journeys. Very happy to state that just last week we had a common pre-departure for UK with the British Council. So Akumen brought more than 16 universities of the UK, And we said that, say, all of you will do some kind of a pre-departure, which leads to what happens at your campus, where to go, who to meet. There'll also be pre-departures by agencies, student recruitment agencies, about, the next steps and all. But how do we set our students up for success by telling what's going to hit them as soon as they land in the country? So we had this massive event at the British Council in Delhi, students and parents, and we touched upon some of these things which were inherent to my experience as well. How do you responsibly, manage your finances for the first time? How do you work out your job versus academic requirements? It's a great experience, but having said that, I think there's a lot international universities have started investing in them. I think they have a lot of sessions, kind of platforms as well. And it's not just pre-departure now, I think it's also post-departure. So there's a lot that happens on campus. I think sizable number of universities have in-country representation. Like for us itself, we work with more than 100 institutions where we are globally setting these teams and people. And I think that training and that expectation settings, setting happens right from the start itself. I have seen in our office itself a lot of students and parents coming, meeting those respective teams, and getting a taste of, what really, goes on. Interestingly, a lot of these in-country reps are also alumni, within these institutions. So they come with their own experience and all. But I feel from where I would have been in that journey 2 decades back as compared to now, one is the institutions are better prepared, they're better oriented for internationalization, but also more interestingly, the students are more aware, more exposed to what can happen, what can. They're more well traveled as well, the parents have better insights. But again, this is still a continuous journey. A simple example of that is as Acumen, we've now got the mandate of study in Japan. So while we feel UK settled, people know what can happen in UK, we're now seeing newer destinations like France, Japan, Germany coming at the Indian doorstep to say, you're more welcome to come to, their countries. How do we now start prepping our students from schools that, internationalization doesn't stop at the Big Four, multiple opportunities, but this is what happens in Japan. This is how their culture, fits in. And so I think that's an interesting journey where we are also moving, exploring destinations.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting. It's I think you with those pre-departure sessions, yeah, I mean you can it's an interesting one because you can share your experiences and give them the students some ideas, but they're not going to know until they actually get there and experience themselves. So it's just I think it's one thing to highlight with that. It's really important to I like to think about that self-awareness, like understanding that when you're there, you're responsible for, I guess, understanding how you're feeling. Where you need to ask for help, what you sort of yeah, like in terms of finances, you're responsible for that now because you're the it's the first time you're responsible for it, but you got to take ownership of that. So I think those two things, like self-awareness and ownership, going into a new country or a new culture, is really important. And you're only going to you only can learn from your experiences, and we can prepare for those pre-departures the best we can and share knowledge. But unless you actually do it, it's hard to, I guess. Yeah, make or tell them exactly what's going to happen. They've got experience for themselves.
True, true, very true.
Yeah. Now, so I just want to, so just with that pressure, I'm really interested to know with the this is coming like me sitting here in Australia. Sometimes we hear that there's in the particularly in Asian countries and I believe India as well. I touched on this before. There seems to be a lot of pressure, whether that's culturally or from families. To do well academically. And from what I understand, that can have a quite a, I guess, negative impact on mental health in young people in Asian countries. Is that fair to say, or is that a bit off mark?
No, it's fair to say to a certain extent where, and again, it comes back to the scale and the kind of, pressures we'll have in terms of the population as well as the opportunities, and how that correlates. For every vacancy that you look in the job sector, there are hundreds and thousands of people who will be happy to apply with the same kind of skill sets. And trying to prove how they can be better suited for that role. And I think that then trickles down from one of those things which really make the difference is your academic pedigree. What are you doing? What's your qualification? How well you've done? I think that's been a traditional kind of a setup in India, where to end up at a comfortable place, given the kind of size we're looking and the opportunities cannot match the population, how do you go up that pyramid and then so. Having said that, I think the newer generation, and I can talk very personally about my wife and I are very clear about. What is that journey that our daughter should take, and to what extent we can influence? I think the newer segments, really, the younger generation, I feel, are more attuned to newer ways of how employability can work. I think India is one of the largest producers for entrepreneurs. There's a lot of ways of how, from a job seeker, you become a job giver. So, and again, how hobbies can become businesses. So a lot of, I think, training at the level of parents is being imparted by schools as well, by institutions, to tell them that how, careers are really shaped. A recent example, we are trying to do something in sports education, is educating the parents and students that sports education doesn't mean that you become an athlete. Which can be a very traditional thinking. There's data science, there is marketing, there's business, and every aspect, there's health sciences within sports. So we're trying to tell them, with each sector, there are varying options. How do we broaden their minds? And there are multiple things we do, let's say with the IB, saying careers of tomorrow. There's something we're doing with Cambridge. Just trying to say how gaming, for example, can change your life, and gaming means that goes behind. But yes, I think traditionally, like you said, a lot of places we still have that pressure of how you sh outshine the peers and be that number one choice.
Having that, having those bragging rights between friends and hopefully healthy competition. But it's really, really interesting what you said there, because there is so many opportunities. Like the young people of today are exposed to, in a way, probably too many opportunities. It gets confusing about the path they want to take, because with AI, like technology, like you're right, like so many people can start their own business and like be quite successful and employ people themselves. It's a really great opportunity. I think there's a, I mean, probably every generation said it, there's no better time to be a young person, but it truly is. It truly is. There's so many opportunities. Now, so I really appreciate your time today. I just wanted to just finish with one question. So if you're willing to share, what's the next state or next step or next thing that Acumen and yourself is working on at the moment and your main focus?
For us, we sit at a very interesting intersection. So it's for us, it's global higher education, it's strategy and market entry. And when all this combines, we sit in this very interesting space with the education leaders across the globe, to tell them what's going to happen in the next few years, what's happening now, and what we've learned from the past. And where we bring a lot of data and intelligences around how certain shifts will shape their own trajectories. Very interestingly, we have started working with institutions across the globe on which are the next big regions where they should start looking at how can they increase diversity, given their own challenges, in-house, with all regulations and policies. But also, I think how each institution brings innovation. Seeing what's happening in certain countries, I think it's one of those first times we are seeing very traditional institutions coming to Acumen and asking, what can we do more? Should we get into skill training? Should we get into some form of online? Other ways of how we work with schools? Is there anything that we can impart, as very innovative kind of models? So I think that's one of the most interesting times where institutions are forced to innovate, and that's where I think companies like Acumen come and they thrive. So we're all bringing our global expertise with peers placed globally to say, while this is happening, Egypt, for example, is doing well. Is there something we should do there? Or Southeast Asia is picking well, so let's try to look at those regions. So for us, I think it's that time period where we're working on two big things. One is how geographically we present solutions. but also how different models can be brought in into the institutions where they're willing to change beyond the basic functions of research and delivery of programs on campus. That's
Really
one of
interesting.
the big areas for us.
Absolutely. Just one point there. You mentioned, like, for example, like Egypt is doing well, you mentioned, and you said you could look into what you could do there. What are some of those things you could do, like, in a new country? What are some of those ideas? Is it opening up a university or helping someone open up a university? How's that work?
So each university, Ash, has a very different appetite. They have a very different vision. But having worked with so many, and I think we've realized there are multiple things the university can come with. And it depends at what level, which office are we talking about. And very simply, to give examples, there are institutions we are talking about where we can open, help them open a campus, where they can start delivering their programs locally. There are institutions who are happy to go to less represented countries than the student community, and to say, let's try to get some of these students there because then it becomes a more global cohort. There are a lot of institutions asking us for research development, within certain countries where, those areas are very prevalent. There are institutions who are helping, who are coming to us saying, we want to work with 100 schools and we want to help them develop some kind of, capabilities, but also help in mobility. A lot of transnational education, a lot of government linkages. So institutions coming and saying, how can we help the government create an education city? And the projects that Acumen is doing in Greece, in India, in Malaysia, Africa. So I think a lot of exciting conversation. Each conversation comes with a very different spin, different vision. So yeah, I think a very interesting time. And this is beyond, so again, just to mention, while we all concentrate on higher education, for India, a very staggering fact which a lot of people overlook is that the higher investment, the higher interest is still in the K-12. So you see a lot of private equity, a lot of international groups coming and investing a lot in the K-12 space. So I think India is very uniquely placed that it's both higher education, K-12, where it's getting a lot of interest at this point.
Unbelievable. It's I really admire what Acumen and yourself are doing, and it blows your mind what opportunities are out there and what's happening around the world, particularly in the international education space, which is fantastic. And really appreciate the time today, Saga, and shared a lot of insights, and I've learned so much today. So hopefully other listeners will work. Oh, sorry, will work. We'll learn a lot too. I think, where can also people find you? I know that you're on LinkedIn. Is there any other ways that people can reach you or follow you?
I think LinkedIn is where you will see the professional avatar, and I would at some point, I keep telling people I love to get into photography. So Instagram is where I generally would put my travel and all. Those are the only two social handles I'm available on.
Brilliant. Well, appreciate your time, Sagar, and thank you for sharing all the insights.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's always good to reflect and share whatever I know. So very happy to be here. Thank you.